Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
In 1959, Aussie doctors Reg and Catherine Hamlin landed in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, for what was meant to be a three-year stint, setting up a midwifery school. But their plans changed dramatically when they began to encounter patients with a type of injury they'd never seen before in Australia, obstetric fistula. That's a hole in the birth canal caused by a long, difficult labour. Most victims are women from remote villages who've given birth with no medical support, and the results are devastating. To put it politely, women with fistula have a permanent leak. They smell like urine and are often abandoned by their families, spending the rest of their lives hidden away as social outcasts. Curing the condition would become the Hamlins' life work. They built a dedicated fistula hospital that has treated over 35,000 women to date. It's now a major teaching institution for surgeons from around the world and has been made famous by books and documentaries. Reg Hamlin passed away in 1993, but Catherine, now at the age of 85, continues to work at the hospital, operating every week with her steady hands. She's currently in Australia, celebrating her golden jubilee, 50 years since the start of her Ethiopian adventure, and I had the privilege of speaking with her recently.
Thank you.
And welcome back. How often do you get back home?
Well, I've been coming a little more frequently lately because the government's been interested in this work, and I've had support from them, and we've also got a very active trust here which likes me to come. In the old days we used to come every 3 years. In the last 3 years I've been twice. This is the third time.
So. Okay. And those steady hands continue to work every week.
Yes, I don't do as much as the other doctors, but I have one day a week when I can have the theatre to myself if I want to. But the other doctors come in too because we've got four tables in the one big theatre. And so I can do one or two cases on a Thursday morning.
Okay.
Which I enjoy doing very much.
I would imagine you do. You've dedicated your whole life to it. Let's go back to the beginning of the story, because in 1959, when you and Reg were first thinking about going to Ethiopia, there were doubters and detractors way back then, weren't there?
Yes. Oh, yes. My mother was upset. She said, I knew Reg would take you to some outlandish country when I rang her from Adelaide. But most people were encouraging, and we wanted to go and work in a developing country because we didn't want to just settle down into general practice together or to obstetric and gynae practice. We thought, well, why don't we go and help in a developing country? We'd both been brought up very well in obstetrics and gynaecology, having worked in Crown Street for many years together, and we realised that we had special skills because every abnormality came into that hospital in Sydney. And we had a Christian faith and we thought, well, let's go and help in a country that needs doctors. Mm-hmm. And we searched around. We had thought of going to New Guinea, and then we answered an advertisement in the Lancet Medical Journal, which is a very prestigious mm-hmm. journal, and we saw this advertisement for Addis Ababa needing a gynaecologist. So we applied.
And away you went, by ship?
To Aden, and then we flew up to Addis Ababa. We sent a cable from the Indian Ocean, but it arrived 2 weeks after we did, so there was nobody to meet us.
That's all right. Now, when there was those doubters and detractors at the beginning, with people kind of wondering whether you should go over to Ethiopia, I believe then Reg had a very interesting experience in a pub.
He did. My little boy, my only child, was six, and he was at a school, a kindergarten school. I was doing some work at the children's hospital, so Reg was taking him to school. He was wondering what to do, whether to go to this country of Ethiopia. And we had been in touch with several missionaries. The mother of one of them was very negative. She said, oh, it's a dreadful place. And anyway, she made us very depressed. So Reg was feeling depressed, and he thought, well, I'll go in and have a beer, sitting quietly. He went into this pub, and he sat down, and there was one other man in the bar as well, and Reg was just sitting quietly thinking. The barman said to him, you seem to have something on your mind, mate. And Reg said, yes, I'm just wondering whether to take my little boy to Ethiopia. And the man sitting next to him said, oh, I've just come from Ethiopia. And it's a wonderful country. There's a beautiful school and he'll love it. Good English school there, and there'll be no problem with schooling. My children went there. And so Reg was very encouraged by this meeting. And he came back and said, "We're going."
God speaks through men in pubs.
Yes.
that's the lesson of the story, isn't it? Beautiful. Yes.
And we never regretted going.
No. So you arrive in Ethiopia. Just describe the improvisation you often had to do when you were doing your kind of work, your medical work, in a hospital in Addis Ababa.
It was actually a very good hospital. It was run and funded by Britain in those days because it was sort of to do with the helping the emperor after the Italian invasion. And so there were several English people in that hospital. Otherwise, it was all Ethiopian staff. But the head surgeon was a very accomplished man called Dr. Azrat. So the hospital was quite well run and it was clean. It was really even better than some of the hospitals are today. Mm. Although we didn't have all the facilities, we didn't have ultrasound, we had x-rays, but there were a lot of things we didn't have.
Mm-hmm. I had read somewhere, though, about a lack of a blood bank and lack of generators and those kinds of things.
We didn't have a generator, we didn't have a blood bank, but we had our own laboratory who would take blood for us, and we could cross-match the blood and we could give them blood if necessary. Mm-hmm. If a woman, for instance, had an ectopic pregnancy where the baby's in the tube and it would burst and it was a fresh one, you could bail the blood out of the abdomen, put it through a sieve and put it back into the woman's bloodstream.
So that was one of the improvisations I guess you did.
My husband brought a big soup ladle from the market and, of course, we sterilised it all and everything. Yeah. We used that to scoop the blood out, put it into the gauze in the funnel and in, back into the patients.
Yes. You know, only a doctor can actually describe what you've just described.
We're
such a lack of
fear. We saved many women that way. Mm-hmm. Mm.
This is Open House right across the nation. Catherine Hamlin is with us. You might know of her story in that very well-known book now. It's called The Hospital by the River, theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast of our conversation with Catherine as well. When you arrived in Ethiopia, you were told what would really kind of become some prophetic words. Somebody actually said to you, "The fistula patients will break your heart."
Yes, they certainly did break our hearts. This was a woman doctor who had been working as a missionary in the country, and then she was working at the same hospital. But she wanted to go back and work in a leprosarium, so she had resigned, and that's why we were able to come to this hospital. We hadn't come across obstetric fistulas in Australia. We had read up all about them. The first man to cure a fistula was in 1850 in Alabama in America. Mostly little slave girls came to him from the South with fistulas because they'd been thrown out because they couldn't work after they got this injury. And he finally perfected a technique using very fine silver wire as a stitch, because he only had horsehair before that, and no catgut or anything like that, and no anaesthetics and no antibiotics. And one little girl he operated on 30 times. And she said, "Please, please try again." And they were so stoical to bear the pain of an operation without an anaesthetic. And he cured her in the end. Mm. So he became very famous. He went all over Europe operating on fistulas until finally when caesarean section came in as a safe procedure, by the end of that century, they have disappeared from the developed world because there were plenty of doctors and plenty of roads, plenty of hospitals where a safe caesarean section could be done.
Describe these fistula pilgrims that you describe in the book. Just give me two or three stories of the kinds of girls that you saw come to your door.
Yes, well, they come to us into the hospital grounds. This is in the general hospital. They wander in their traditional clothes, which are usually very dirty and soaked with urine. They just come with faith and hope that something can be done for them. And they're pathetic little figures. Very often the guards at the gate would turn them away because they had no money. They said, "You can't come in here. This is a paying hospital." And so they would disappear. And my husband used to often get up in the early morning and find them. He would go out looking for them we had a big compound around the hospital. And he would find these girls wandering away, leaving. And he would say, "Why are you going away? I'm not wanted. I can't get help here." And he would, of course, take them back, get them admitted. So they had problems even to just get into the hospital. And the stories they tell us getting onto a bus in the countryside and trying to hide that they were wet. Mm. Some of them, of course, had bowel incontinence as well, which made their plight much, much worse. And they were often turned off the buses. One sat on a tin at the back, hoping the urine would drip into the tin and nobody would notice. Mm. And many were turned off the buses. Some just walked to us, taking months to get there. Two of them rode on a horse together. This is in the early days. They came together on a horse and wanted to be done together because they needed to go back on the horse. They are ashamed of this injury. They don't want to mix with anyone. And the other patients despise them in a general hospital because they're smelling, because they're poor, because they're dressed in, not rags, but in the traditional country dress. And usually it was dirty and usually it was soaked in urine. And so they never got a welcome. Nobody loved them.
They're rejected by everybody, aren't they?
Yes.
Family?
We would find them in the outpatients sitting. We'd have a big clinic in the mornings with everyone coming to be seen, and they would always be sitting away from all the others. And my husband would find them and bring them in and take them in first. He was so kind to them. And he said, "You're my special patient. I'm going to look after you." And just to give them a little bit of love, you know, just to think about them makes me cry. Mm. What they go through, nobody knows. They're young women that have just got married some years ago and having their first baby often, thinking, "Well, I'm going to have a lovely baby and I'm going to be so happy." And then this disaster strikes them. Then their husband, of course, he can't cope with the situation. He's just a peasant boy, probably only a few years older. They might be 16 or 17. He might be in his early 20s. And he'll say, "I can't live with you." And she would often say to the husband, "I have to go away and leave you. I can't be any good to you anymore as a wife." And she would say, "Give me back to my mother and father." And so the mother and father would take her back, but they couldn't cope with it either because they couldn't have their family with them in the same small house. They couldn't have their relatives in or their neighbours in to drink coffee and to have a little coffee ceremony, which is such an important thing in Ethiopia. And so this little girl would be completely isolated from everything that made her happy. Mm. And she would be put in some dark shed on her own. Thousands of them must be all over Africa, hiding away because they're ashamed, because they're leaking urine, because they're smelling. They have no underclothes, no pants, no pads, nothing to help the urine to be soaked up. And they might have two dresses to their name. They might have to go out at night and wash the one dress to keep it clean. Their stories are so devastating. With you don't have to be a Christian even. Anyone would feel compassion for such patients.
This is Open House across the nation. And you're hearing the story of Catherine Hamlin, who has, along with her husband Reg, pioneered the work of fistula operations throughout Ethiopia and, in fact, throughout Africa. And indeed, it's touching. It's a very touching story indeed. Just to hear the fact that after so many years of doing this, 50 years in fact this year, it still brings a tear to your eye when you think of these women that you have helped, that you've come across, that you continue to help every day. How have you been able to keep on going when obviously it is such an emotionally heartbreaking situation?
It's so exciting, of course, when you cure them. And this is the joy that we, as fistula surgeons, all get, to see a woman cured from a devastating injury. Sometimes it's a very difficult surgical procedure. Sometimes it's very easy. It depends on the size of the hole. It depends on the scarring that occurs in the vagina. And it depends on whether it's a double fistula, like a big hole in the rectum and the bladder as well. But when you've cured them, the excitement of seeing them suddenly feel that they're normal women again is so overwhelming that it's a joy to work there.
Well, tell me about a story of a lady who did have her life restored then. What kind of effects happen once they are cured?
Yes, well, I will tell you a story about my husband. He was in the car one day in Addis driving and the lights went red and he stopped and a woman put her face through the window and gave him a great kiss on the cheek. And just on the street. And he said, "What did you do that for?" She said, "Because you cured my fistula and I've had two babies and I love you."
Ah, beautiful.
So that was a story. Another one I had, she'd been dripping urine for 40 years. She was 60. And she said, I had my only baby at 20. She had a very simple, easy fistula to cure. And she was cured after about 10 days post-operative. She was quite dry and voiding normally. She said, I love you next to God. And she said, I said, think I could have been cured. I could have had more children. I didn't know. And I've been sitting alone for 40 years. Mm. We sometimes have a dance in the ward with five or six patients all ready to go home. We give them a new dress and we give them a new headscarf often and perhaps a new shawl. We've had wonderful people in Australia making shawls for us and knitting to give them a present to go home with and to encourage them to get another husband and to try and have another baby. In fact, we've got a ward just for pregnant women who come back to us after a fistula repair, and it's so encouraging for the patients to see a woman coming back with a baby inside her waiting for a delivery when they're suffering from this condition because they think, well, perhaps this will happen to me.
I bet. We've mentioned briefly about your faith, a very strong Christian faith. Tell me about when that became a real guiding reality for you. Were you raised in a Christian home?
Yes, I was, but I was just a nominal Christian for a long time. I just remember one particular occasion when I was... we went to hear a famous preacher in Sydney, Presbyterian, called Mr. Peyton, and he spoke on Jesus after the resurrection, talking to Peter and telling Peter, feed my lambs, feed my sheep, three times, remember? Mm. And I was affected by this sermon very much, and I remember going home and kneeling and asking God to give me the same encouragement that he gave to Peter, and I really gave my life to Jesus. I think I was a Christian before that, but this was a turning point in my life.
A wholehearted commitment
in
life.
And I know that we were called to go to Ethiopia. My husband should have been appointed to Crown Street as an honorary.
We should fill in for people who don't understand the phrase Crown Street.
Yes, Crown Street was
well-known.
A very big hospital in Sydney. It was very famous for obstetrics and gynaecology. And we had an honorary system in those days where the superintendent of the hospital nearly always got onto the staff as an honorary, which meant that they would be able to use that hospital for their private patients, but they had to come and help with the public patients as well. So nearly always the superintendent became an honorary, and my husband should have become an honorary because he was a superintendent for over 10 years, had some wonderful results from his work, and particularly in the a condition of toxemia of pregnancy, which he almost eradicated from at a maternal death. Yeah. He wrote all this up. And the chief honorary also wrote a paper of the similar condition. And my husband's paper got quite a lot of adulation from medical journals, and his was put into the Lancet Medical Journal, which is that one I mentioned before, and into the big journal of obstetrics and gynecology. And the honorary surgeons wasn't put in. And he became extremely jealous of my husband. And he said to him one day, while I'm on the staff as an honorary, you'll never get onto this hospital. And so that was rather a blow. And we realized afterwards, of course, that it was God's will that we shouldn't get onto that hospital.
Yes. Did you always want to do gynecology? Was it something that you'd always wanted to do?
No, I was very keen on children's work as a student, and then I thought, well, I'll go and see what Crown Street's like. And actually, I was interviewed by my husband when he was the medical director then. He said, well, if you're not, you have to be dedicated if you want to do obstetrics. No use wanting to do children's and applying to come here and put me in my place. So I said, well, I think I want to do obstetrics and gynecology.
So what have you learned about the call of God and the vocational pathway that people have? Because here you and Reg then have dedicated your lives to something that you never would have foreseen before you went to Ethiopia.
No, we certainly wouldn't have foreseen it. And I had thought in my youth it would be wonderful to be a missionary because I grew up in a Christian family and many of my family were missionaries, especially an old uncle from the Congo who used to, as children, we were really excited to have him come because he'd tell us the most wonderful stories. Mm-hmm. And he promised to bring me a monkey, but he never did.
So, I mean, there are people who will be listening to us and saying, you know, I'm still wanting to know what I should be doing with my life and maybe what God wants me to do with my life. What's your advice to them, given what you've experienced over your life?
Well, I think if you just keep near to God and if you keep near to Jesus in prayer and His Holy Spirit will guide them. I don't think it's any good making a decision on your own and just thinking, I'll do this. God will guide you, I think, just through general things often. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult. I think it's very difficult to know whether you're being guided or not. I didn't know when I went to Ethiopia. I wasn't sure at all until some years afterwards we realised that this was where we should be spending our lives.
Yes, it's easier to see the hand of God when you look back rather than looking forward, isn't it? Yes. Open House is what you're listening to. Catherine Hamlin is our special guest tonight. You may know of her work through the very well-known book, The Hospital by the River, the fistula hospital that she and her husband Reg set up in Ethiopia back in 1959, 50th anniversary of the work. Keeping on the faith topic, when you and Reg did start the hospital, because you've been talking about the work you actually did in the government hospital, you did start the hospital by the river.
Yeah.
You really ran that hospital by faith. It really was God's miraculous provision in many cases that kept it going. Can you give me some examples?
Yes. After about 10 years, we realised that we couldn't cope with the number of patients coming to us because we couldn't get them admitted. We'd already built hostels in the grounds of the general hospital. We had 60 patients waiting there for their surgery, and there was no way that we could reduce that number quickly because as soon as one came in, others came. And so we thought, well, why don't we build our own hospital? We took a long time to decide that because we thought, well, we'll never get permission to build a hospital in a foreign country. So there were problems. We had to get permission from the emperor, and he was wonderfully sympathetic. He came many times to visit the fistula patients, and he said to my husband once, why do my women get this injury? And my husband said, it's not your women, Your Majesty, it's your country, the size of your country, and the lack of medical facilities in the provinces. I always said, I'm glad it's not anything to do with my women. And he looked upon them all as his children. He was a wonderful man, and he was very concerned about these women. And so we got permission very quickly from him to build a hospital, to buy land. And then he said, of course, you'll have to get permission from my Ministry of Health. We went to the Ministry of Health because we were on good terms with them. And they said, we will let you do this if you promise not to come to us for money. So we said, yes, no, we won't. We'll raise the money ourselves. And so we searched for land then, and we were able to find a very nice block of land on a hillside. Had a wonderful answer to prayer, really. There was a factory just behind the piece that we had chosen, run by some Italians. And Reg went in there. We were on horseback looking for land. He and I were riding. And we went in and we said, where did you get your nice piece of land from? Because there's a lovely bit in front of you, which we would like to get for a hospital. And this Italian man said, well, all this land is owned by the Armenian community. If you go to them, they'll probably sell it. So we did that. We set up a little Armenian church there. We sat in the back with a whole lot of old men with beards looking like Abraham. These were the elders. We had to discuss the price and everything. And we got the land for a certain price. And I think a few days later, we got the exact amount, almost the exact amount, from the Kellogg's Foundation in America. Because my husband used to write to all these foundations.
Yeah.
And we started to build the hospital.
Mm-hmm. And what about when the hospital was actually constructed and running and the provision that you experienced during those days?
Well, we had to keep begging, really. My husband was a very good letter writer, and he wrote to, I remember, the head of BP, Sir Henry Drake, and he said, Sir Henry, while you have been drilling holes in the Middle East and making a profit, we've been closing holes in the Horn of Africa at a loss, and can you help us? So he said, I was so touched with your letter that I'm sending you £5,000 from my own pocket. And so, but we got money. And gradually we got everything together.
And we must paint a picture of what your fistula work now has become. You have centres now in how many areas?
We have four centres actually running. The fifth one should be finished by the end of February or the beginning of February, we hope. It's in way down in the southwest corner of Ethiopia in a province called Ilubaba, which is very poorly medically supplied with any doctors or nurses, and there are lots and lots of women suffering with this injury down there. There's a big hospital which the Germans built, a German organisation called Menschen der Menschen, which I think means people for people. And they built a good hospital there, but no doctors want to stay there. It's so remote and so difficult to educate children or to have a family there. So it's a difficult place, but we found they have a big grounds and they've given us plenty of space to build our centre there, which will be a 40-bed ward with an operating theatre and just the simple facilities that we need. We've got the centres already going in Bardar, with Dr. Andrew Browning, who's an Australian, running that centre in Bardar, which is in the province of Gojam, which has got 28 million people. There are only three gynaecologists in the whole of that area. Then there's one up in Tigray in the north and one over in the east in Hera, a very big Muslim area. So lots of Somali women come there. And then down in the south at a place called Yirrkalem, which is on the road going down to Nairobi, to Kenya. And then this last one is in Metu.
And then in 2007 was the Midwifery College?
Yes. Well, this is now what I wanted to tell you about in Australia. We've been sewing these women up and repairing them and doing all this work to mend them. But what are we doing to prevent this injury? People say, what are you doing to prevent this injury? We've done nothing. We went there to found a school of midwifery, which we failed to establish because the government didn't have money to fund it. And so now we have got money to fund a school of midwifery. The government's been very generous to us, given us 24 acres of land adjacent to another area that they gave us to set up a farm and a rehabilitation centre for women that we can't cure in the normal way. It's in a little valley with a semicircular hills behind, and the Midwifery College has been put right beside that area. We haven't quite finished building all the buildings, and we've got accreditation from the government. A lot of money from Australia has been given for the Midwifery College. The first intake 3 years ago was 12 students. The second intake was 12 students. And this year, just a few months ago, we took on 20 students. And gradually, we're going to build it up. After 3 years, they'll become bachelors of midwifery. And these girls have all been taken from the countryside, from the high schools, the 12th grade students from the high schools. We don't take anyone from Addis Ababa because they would never stay in the countryside. So we take them from the area where they've grown up. We'll send them back to that area. We'll build them a house to live in. They'll work with a traditional birth attendant. They'll be attached to a health centre where the government is training health officers to do safe cesarean sections. So they'll have somewhere to refer their patients to. They will become not only birth attendants and birth delivery of normal babies, but they will be diagnosticians. They can tell if a woman is likely to become obstructed, and they will get them to some facility before she starts her labour. So often these women wait until the third or fourth day of labour and then try to struggle to a hospital. Of course, it's too late, and the difficulty they get travelling is so enormous that they give up and go home to die. The fistulas are just the survivors of the maternal death that occurs in an obstructed labour. And so we will be able to help the maternal death rate, which is the highest in Africa.
Well, I'll give people the website where people can help you continue that work in just a minute.
Thank you.
How long do you think you can keep this up?
I've got a wonderful staff. I've got four fistula surgeons working with me at the Fistula Hospital. We've got Ethiopians in all our centres except for Andrew. And we've got a wonderful staff of nurses and matron and wonderful sisters. They're dedicated to do this. We've got a clean, beautiful hospital. Lots of people want to come to our hospital. We were told at the beginning nobody will come near the Fistula Hospital. It'll be so smelly. People come in from overseas and say this is the cleanest hospital we've seen in Africa, certainly, and almost in the world. And we've got money to spend to look after these patients. But we need money to spend to prevent this injury. We need to develop this midwifery college. And the cost is going to be very high as we start to deploy the girls into the countryside. And many countries from Africa want to follow our curriculum. They think it's the answer for the problem with maternal death and with these fistula problems. So we're very encouraged, but we need money to help us keep going.
Yeah. And do you have any less energy today than what you did a couple of years ago? It seems like you could just keep on going and going and going personally.
Have I got any? I love living there, and I've got a home there, and I've got a beautiful garden, and I've got beautiful people to look after me if I get ill. I can't see the point of coming to live in Australia where I'd have to get on trams and buses and things. And I love my life there.
Yeah.
So I haven't any plans to retire. If I die, the work will go on. Mm-hmm. So that's very encouraging to us.
Well, it's an exciting story, and it continues to go on. And like you said, this work will continue to go on and just flourish and flourish.
I'm sure that God will keep us going, because he loves these women far more than I do. And his heart must be broken to see their condition.
Yes.
And I know that he'll help us as he's helped us in the past.
Yes, absolutely. Just one more thing. You know, I can't help but think that as you've told your story and as it's been told in books and documentaries and things, you and Reg made a fantastic team, didn't you?
We did. And when he died, I was devastated, of course. I thought, well, how will I carry on? And I remember my faithful servant man has been with me since the beginning of... We were there, he came, I was sitting on the veranda. I think I was reading my Bible, I'm not sure, but I was contemplating the future. And I must have looked sad, and he came and sat beside me, and knelt down beside me and kissed the back of my hand and said, "Don't leave us, we'll all help you." Mm. So that touched my heart.
Catherine Hamlin, it's just been very encouraging to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time in Open House tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah, Catherine Hamlin, who is the founder, along with her late husband Reg, of the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital. Now, I'm sure that after you've heard the story, you're going to be keen to find out more. Here's the website, fistulatrust.org. F-I-S-T-U-L-A, trust, fistulatrust.org.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.